But the text is 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 14 through 22, or you can just read it off the screen with me. The Bible says, "Then the Lord raised up an adversary to Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the royal line in Edom, for it came about when David was in Edom, and Joab, the commander of the army, had gone up to bury the slain, and had struck down every male in Edom. For Joab and all Israel stayed there 6 months, until he had cut off every male in Edom. That Hadad fled to Egypt, he and certain Edomites of his father's servants with him, while Hadad was a young boy. And they arose from Midian and came to Paran, and they took men with them from Paran and came to Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave him a house and assigned him food and gave him land. Now Hadad found great favor before Pharaoh, so that he gave him in marriage the sister of his own wife, the sister of Tophanes, the queen. And the sister of Tophanes bore his son, Genubath, whom Tophanes weaned in Pharaoh's house. And Genubath was in Pharaoh's house among the sons of Pharaoh. But when Hadad heard in Egypt that David slept with his fathers, and that Joab, the commander of the army, was dead, Hadad said to Pharaoh, 'Send me away, that I may go to my own country.' Then Pharaoh said to him, 'But what have you lacked with me, that behold, you are seeking to go to your own country?' And he answered, 'Nothing. Nevertheless, you must surely let me go.'" The Old Testament prodigal. One of the best known and most beloved stories of the Bible was told by Jesus and recorded in the 15th chapter of St. Luke's Gospel, and is best known as the story of the prodigal son. A father who apparently was quite wealthy had two sons. The younger rebels against his father, demands his inheritance in advance, which is scandalous even to this day to Middle Easterners, because they understand that he is asking for that which he has no right to as long as his father is alive. So in essence, he is saying to his dad, "I can't wait for you to die. I wish you were dead." There was an utter rejection and repudiation of his father and his father's house. And he leaves home and he journeys to a far country where he engaged in a reckless lifestyle of wine, women, and song. At first it was fun. But soon his money was gone, along with his self-respect and all of his so-called friends. And when he had squandered his inheritance and his friends deserted him, he found himself homeless and living on the streets. Had his story taken place today, you would probably have found him at a busy intersection holding a crude cardboard sign that says, "We'll work for food," or pushing a grocery cart from Save Mart loaded with tin cans. The ancient Middle Eastern equivalent was to take a job feeding pigs. And it is there at the pigsty, penniless, starving, dirty, and disgraced, that he remembered his father's house. And he makes the monumental decision to return home. The rest of the story is a picture of unfathomable love and mercy. The mercy of God graphically portrayed in the gracious mercy of the boy's father, who sees him coming, runs to meet him, embraces him and kisses him and kisses him and kisses him, restores his dignity, forgives his transgression, covers his shame, and reestablishes him as a son in the father's house. It is a wonderful story that touches the deepest places of our hearts. And among the messages that it teaches us, we should learn from the prodigal son that sin will always take you further than you intended to go. It will keep you longer than you intended to stay, and it will cost you more than you intended to pay. But in all fairness, perhaps we should ask this question. Does every prodigal who rejects the father's house and spurns the father's love, do they all end up at the hog pen? Do they all crash and burn in the far country? Do they all end up begging in the streets? And the honest answer to that question is no, they don't. There are many prodigals who are living far, far from God, who are doing quite well. They're doing very well. They have a good job. They have a promising career. They have a respectable place in the community. They earn a good living. They live in a nice house. They perhaps wear designer clothes and tailor-made suits. They drive a luxury car, SUV. They own a cabin in the mountains or a vacation home at the beach or a condo. They have a substantial retirement, but they seldom think of God. He has very little place, if any, in their life or in their thoughts, and certainly no place in their hearts. And the truth is, there are some prodigals who are doing quite well in this world, in this life. So what about them? Well, as it turns out, the younger son in the Lord's story isn't the only prodigal in the Bible. He is the New Testament prodigal, but we've just read a text from 1 Kings that describes another prodigal, the Old Testament prodigal, and he presents the other side of the coin. And we read this text, we learned the story of this young man, and I'm assuming that this is probably for many of you a character that you've probably paid no attention to at all, and a story that has escaped your notice. But it takes place during the time of King Solomon, the third and final king of Israel's monarchy prior to the divided kingdom of Israel and Judah. And there had been a six-month military campaign led by Joab, who was the commander of David's army, against the nation of Edom. And the invasion resulted in a massive loss of life among the Edomite men. When it says that he cut off every male in Edom, it refers to those men who were old enough to bear arms. He's talking about the army. Most of the boys in Edom would have been safe. There would have been no threat against them. But there was one young boy who was very much at risk, and his name was Hadad. His life was in considerable jeopardy for the simple reason that he was a prince. He was of the royal line and would be in line to inherit the throne. And it was normal military practice to put to death all heirs to the throne so that no one could rise up later to avenge the king and reclaim the throne. And understanding this, Hadad's father, fearing for his son's life, arranged for him to be secreted away to Egypt, far away from Joab's sword. His servants were given charge over the boy, and from Edom, which is located south of the Dead Sea, they journeyed past Petra and on to Midian, which is north of the Gulf of Aqaba, east of the Sinai Peninsula. And there they traveled on to Egypt, which became home for the young boy named Hadad. And just as Joseph and Mary would one day flee for safety to Egypt to protect the infant Messiah from Herod's sword, but centuries later, before their epic journey, Hadad found refuge in Egypt from Joab and his army. And the Bible just tells us that he made his home there and he grew up. A lot of those early years, there was no mention, so we don't really know what it was all about, and we don't have a lot of the details about how all of it, what transpired, how all of it took place. But it does tell us that while living in Egypt, Hadad grew from a boy into manhood. And it also tells us of the astonishing acts of kindness conferred upon him by Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. For reasons that are not given in the narrative, Hadad, for whatever reason, found favor in the eyes of the king. It is grace, pure grace. We're not told why. Was it because he had learned that Hadad was a prince and of royal stock? We don't know. Was it because he had compassion upon a scared boy? We don't know that either. We're not told why, only that Hadad found great favor in the eyes of Egypt's king. And if you were paying attention, you notice how he blesses him. The first thing is, he gave him a house. Now, that's a pretty good gift. I mean, he gave him a house. And let me ask you this, what kind of house would a king give? We don't know, but I think you can be pretty sure it wasn't a shack. It wasn't a shanty. And then he gave him land. Land. There were no doubt many among the Egyptians who were not landowners, but this foreigner, this vagabond, this alien who fled for refuge, is now given land by the king. And again, you can imagine what kind of gift the king would give. Then the Bible said that he assigned him food. And we're not given the details of that. We don't know. Was he given just given access to the king's cupboard, to the king's pantry? Or did he give him fields and servants to tend and harvest the crops along with cooks to prepare the meals? We don't know, but I think we can be sure that if it came from a king, it wasn't TV dinners. You realize the enormous amount of wealth this represents? I mean, even among affluent Americans, this represents a large investment. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, at least, and depending on the size of the house and the land and all of this, it could have been in the millions of dollars. And if a king or anyone were to offer to give you land, a house, and take care of all of your meals, I don't think it would hurt your feelings, would it? Would it? No. But when you think about it, not in the context of American culture, but in the context of the culture at the time this occurred, it was an exorbitant, lavish gift beyond comprehension. When you think of the power and the wealth of a king, what kind of house, what kind of land, what kind of gift would he be able to give? And the overwhelming majority of the people living at that time would never have even the most remote chance of being blessed in such an extraordinary measure as this. Not even the Egyptians themselves. Most of them would live their whole lives either in poverty or near it, just barely eking out a living. And what Hadad achieved and received is absolutely unprecedented and to somewhat unexplained. His entrance into Egypt was less than glorious. A death sentence on his head, on the run, fleeing certain death, a contract out on his life, and he comes into Egypt and wins the lottery. He probably would have been grateful just to find a safe place of refuge, would have been grateful for a sparse existence, just to be able to live, but instead he is blessed beyond description and beyond imagination. And listen, material blessings, they're just the beginning. The narrative goes on to tell us that Pharaoh was so impressed with him that he gave him a wife. And the Bible says that whoever finds a wife has found a good thing. I guess that's assuming it's the right wife. But not just any wife. The wife he gives him is his own sister-in-law. Tophanes was the wife of Pharaoh, and it was her sister who became Hadad's wife. He has now married into the royal family of Egypt. And then when it seems that things couldn't possibly get any better, they did, because he had the greatest blessing of all. They had a son. They had a child whom they named Genubath. And the Bible said that he was weaned in the house of Pharaoh. It means he grew up playing with princes. He grew up rubbing shoulders with royalty, his son. So he's no longer a stranger running for his life. He is married into the king's family. He is part of the royal court with all the privilege, power, prestige, and wealth that went with it. He rubs shoulders with royalty. He's on a first-name basis with the powerful and the elite. He dines with aristocrats and the affluent, and all the power and wealth of Egypt is at his fingertips. It is an incredible from-rags-to-riches story. But an interesting thing occurs in this story, and it catches us a bit by surprise, as it did the king of Egypt. While living in the lap of luxury, with everything that any man could desire in this life, and all the things that people in our culture use to measure success and affluence and blessing, I mean, what has he lacked? And that's the question the king is going to ask him. He receives word that David and Joab have died, and all of those who seek his life are gone, and the threat is removed, and Edom is safe again. And when he hears this, Hadad goes to Pharaoh with a petition in verse 21 that is absolutely astonishing. He asks, "Send me away that I may go to my own country." And the king is stunned. He is more than surprised. He is astonished. And he asks, "What have you lacked with me?" And Hadad said, no, there are many people in life, if you ask them, what do you lack? Is there anything you lack? Because everybody's got a wish list, right? And it gets longer, right? Most all of you got a wish list. Do you lack anything? And he said, no, I haven't lacked anything. I mean, why would you possibly want to go back to your own country? And Hadad agrees. He said, I've lacked nothing. Nevertheless, you must surely let me go. And the king doesn't begin to understand his request, and perhaps people listening to this would have trouble understanding it too. But in essence, the king said, Hadad, you have had everything your heart could dream of. Everything and more that you could possibly imagine, beyond anything you could have imagined. You have wealth and security, you have power, you have prestige, you have privilege, you have a beautiful wife. Your son plays with princes in the palace. You have lacked nothing. What could you possibly hope to gain by returning to Edom? Why would you want to leave all of this? And Hadad can argue with his logic, and he doesn't. He says, the king is right. I've lacked nothing. I've been blessed with more than I could have possibly dreamed of. His life was full of the things most people will never see or touch even once in their life. But though his hands are full, his heart is empty. And there came a day when all he wanted to do was go home. He was a prodigal, every bit as much as the New Testament story, a son far from his father's house. But he wasn't broke. He was wealthy beyond measure. He was homeless for a while, or he wasn't homeless. He had been homeless, a prodigal. He's not homeless. He lives in a house fit for a king. He was a prodigal, but he didn't feed himself with husk from the corn for pigs. He ate the choicest foods and the rare delicacies of Egypt from the king's table. He wasn't the slave of a Gentile pig farmer. He socialized with royalty. He was a prodigal, but he wasn't an outcast. He was a member of the Egyptian court. But there came a day when the palace, as big and beautiful as it was, seemed empty and lonely. And there came a day when the king's meat tasted flat. And there came a day when all that he'd acquired and all of his possessions seemed like vanity. And there came a day when all that he achieved and all that he accomplished could not satisfy a deep, unmet need and longing deep within him. And there was an empty place inside of him that all the wealth, the power, the pleasure, and prestige of the world could not fill. And he left it all just to go home again. And you see, it doesn't matter if you're a prodigal at a pig pen or a prince in a palace. There is within the depths of every heart a longing for home. The preacher in Ecclesiastes said of God, you have put eternity in their hearts. There is a deep place that only God can fill. And St. Augustine said, Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until we rest in you. And like the prodigal of the New Testament, Hadad, the Old Testament prodigal, turned his back on the far country and all that it afforded just to go home again. Be it ever so humble, there is no place like home. We know it's true. Home captures our heart in a way that no other word does. And I believe that God has put a homing instinct in all of us. He certainly put it in the lower creation, did he not? I lived in Yakima, Washington. We'd play golf on Mondays, and certain times of the year we'd stand there and we'd watch those big Canadian geese flying overhead, migrating for the winter in those perfect formations. And you notice those, the shape, there's always, one side is longer than the other. And the reason for that is there's more birds on one side than on the other. And we'd stand there in awe and look at those magnificent animals. And you have to wonder, they fly to a warmer climate. They fly the same unmarked passageway every year. They never get lost. They have no compass. They always find their way back home. Lower animals. Salmon, the fish, do the same thing. When it comes time to spawn, they swim upstream and fight against powerful currents just to find their way home. How do they know? And they will go back to the very inlet or pool where they were spawned ever how long ago it was. It's an amazing thing. How do these animals with obviously limited intelligence, how do they find their way? There was a homing instinct. How many times in the bush country, when people were lost, many a lost soul just let go of the reins and gave the horse his head, and the horse was able to find their way back home. Maybe you've experienced it with that dog or cat you tried to get rid of, and you put them in the car, and you drove out and round in circles and let them out, and you went home, and you pulled up in the drive, they were sitting on the front porch waiting on you. Even in the movies, the thing E.T. wanted most of all was just to go home. Now, I find it remarkable to consider that God would put this instinct in the lower animals and not put it in man. Would God guide the birds of the sea and the fish and the birds of the air and the fish in the sea and the beast of the field, but allow man to lose his way? No. That empty place inside of you, that restlessness in your heart, that yearning for something more than money and something more than pleasure and something more than mere existence, more than success, that hunger in your heart for meaning, for purpose, for significance, for something that lasts, it was put there by God. And the deepest yearning of the human soul is for God Himself. And the same God who called the prodigal back to his father's house, the same God that called Hadad back to Edom, is the same God that is calling to your heart to come home again. I experienced that very thing. I didn't live in a palace. I didn't rub shoulders with royalty. But I wasn't homeless. I was there very much a prodigal. Grew up in church. Came to a place in my life where I said, I've had enough of this. Don't need God. Don't want anything to do with God. Don't want to do anything to church, with church. And when I get on my own, now, while I'm at home, I got to live by the rules. And at our house, we went to church. If you were alive and breathing, you went to church. I don't ever remember getting up on a Sunday and ask, are we going to church or not? You had to be half dead. If you were sick, they took you to church and prayed for you. You had to be half dead not to go. And so we went to church, and I had to live by those rules. But I kind of waited for the day. I kind of waited for the day when I'd be on my own and I could do my own thing. And so when that day comes, I'm through with God, through with the church. Well, you see how that turned out, don't you? And it finally came. I left home and I went to college. And for the most part, you know, Panama City was never really home again. And then I got my first job teaching school in Decatur, Alabama. And I remembered very well the day I drove in. Before I went to Decatur, I called up there and a friend was helping me locate an apartment. And I remember the name. It was Bel Air Apartments on 16th Avenue in Decatur. Maybe it was 11th Avenue in Decatur. And I had arranged, I already sent him a check to the landlord, and he was holding a deposit, and I had the address, so I knew where I was going. And I had my car, and I had the smallest U-Haul trailer that you can buy. Boy, has that changed. At that time, everything I owned would fit in that trailer. And I remember pulling into Decatur, and this is absolutely the truth. I pulled in Decatur and I said out loud, because there was no, just to myself because nobody was in the car with me, but I said out loud, I said, at last I'm free. My mother and dad, they're in Panama City, hundreds of miles away. I don't want to worry about them. My brother, he's off up in Minnesota. My sister, she lives in Dallas, Texas at the time. I am finally on my own. I'm free. I am through with God. I'm through with church. I'm especially through with the church of God, and I'm never going back again. I said it out loud. I'm free. My emancipation. I turned right off of the main highway, Highway 31, onto 11th and headed north, following the directions. And then I got to the intersection of 11th and 16th. It was a four-way stop, and there were several cars in front of me. And I was sitting there waiting for my turn to go, and I looked up ahead, and I saw the apartment building and the sign, big sign, Bel Air Apartments. And it was a nice place. It was relatively new, and I was like, wow, man, this is a cool place where I'm going to be living. That's where I'm living. That's home. So I pulled up. Finally, I got up to the stop sign, but I had to stop again. And when I stopped, as I was waiting, making sure it was clear, I glanced over on the right corner across from me. There was a big vacant field over there. And I looked, and right smack dab in the, this is the truth, absolutely the truth, this huge sign that said, "Future Home of the Church of God." And I went, I have all these miles to get away, and I am living next door. And the Oak Park Church of God is on that corner to this very day. I thought, wow, you can't get away. The hounds of heaven will find you. And one boy, I heard a story of a young boy who, his story is pretty much the same. And, you know, finally he gets away and he gets on a plane and flies, you know, somewhere else. And finally, I'm free. And he gets in the cab and sits down and gives the cabbie the address. And he said, "Sure, son, I'll take you there. By the way, son, do you know Jesus is your Lord and Savior?" And I'm like, wow. I came to thank God for the Church of God on that corner. Because what took place there was formational and absolutely changing my life. I finally came to a place in my own life where, no, I had a respectable job. I wasn't going to get rich teaching school. I knew that. But I had a good job, had a respectable place in the community. I had a nice place to live. I had decent car, decent clothes. I wasn't a thug on the street. I wasn't selling dope. I wasn't a criminal, respectable member of the society. A lot of the marks of things that people would use to measure success, they were there. But there was an emptiness inside of me that nothing of this world could fill. Nothing. Not pleasure, not money, not prestige, not accomplishment. And what I found was a heart yearning for home. And when I returned, I found what the prodigal found. A father running to meet me with arms open wide to restore, to love, to forgive, establish me as a son in his house.